And then Professor Hill says, I don't recall a specific statement, and I cannot say whether that comment would have stuck in my mind. I really cannot say that. Well, the conversation goes on, but my time is just about to run out. And I read this at some length to really show a number of things. One is that you have to get right into the specifics on the testimony to understand what she is saying. And a fair reading, nine questions, Professor Hill flatly says, I think a fair reading of this is that she says she had no conversation with a Senate staffer about her coming forward might get Judge Thomas to withdraw. Now then, back in the afternoon session, I asked Professor Hill, as it shows on page 203 of the record, if you could proceed from there to recount who called you and what those conversations consisted of as it led to your coming forward to this committee. Professor Hill. Well, we discussed a number of different issues. We discussed one, that he knew about the law on sexual harassment. We discussed what he knew about the process of bringing information forward to the committee. And in the course of our conversations, Mr. Brundy asked me what were specifics about what it was that I had experienced. In addition, we talked about the process for going forward, what might happen if I did bring information to the committee. That included an investigation might take place, and that I might be questioned by the committee in closed session. It even included something to the effect that the information might be presented to the candidate or to the White House. There was some indication that the nominee might not wish to continue the process. Close quote. Mr. President, when I heard that, I was very surprised. And then my next question is, Mr. Brudney said to you that the nominee, Judge Thomas, might not wish to continue the process if you came forward with a statement on the factors which you have testified about? Professor Hill. Well, I'm not sure that that is exactly what he said. I think what he said was, depending on an investigation, a Senate, whether the Senate went into closed session and so forth, it might be that he might not wish to continue the process. And my next question, so Mr. Brudney did tell you that Judge Thomas might not wish to continue to go forward with his nomination if you came forward? Professor Hill, yes. Flat out, finally. Nine questions in the morning, a fair reading, a denial by Professor Hill. Then she comes back to it in a way which I have read specifically, which...
Would my colleague yield?
Absolutely not. I'm going to finish this discussion, and then I'd be glad to yield.
Thank you. On his time, not yours.
Thank you, Senator Thurmond, on his time, not mine. But I'm on an important point, and I've been talking about it for about 15 minutes, and I really want to get to the point without an interruption, and then I'd be delighted to discuss it with Senator Simon or anybody else. Now, I have gone through this, Mr. President, in detail because my colleagues really ought to know the specifics. We have a question of credibility, whether Judge Thomas is correct or whether Professor Hill is correct. And it is not an easy matter ever to question anybody about anything. But I would suggest to my colleagues that the questioning of Professor Hill...
The senator from Pennsylvania's time has expired.
Mr. President, I yield 5 more minutes to stand in front of the
Senator is recognized for 5 additional minutes.
It is not an easy matter to question anybody about anything really at any time. But in the context of this case, this was a very important matter and very difficult. And for 9 times, the question was raised. And I asked my colleagues to focus on the specifics. And I've taken the time that I'm allotted when there are many, many other important things to say. And I haven't really finished all the testimony that it goes on. I ask that the record be included up to 208. I've only gone to 204. And I took a look at the testimony last night, saw some of it on C-SPAN, interested to see the tone of it. And I did my best to be polite. I think I was. The New York Times said I was painstakingly polite. But the substance here is, what did she say? And in the morning, 9 questions, responding to the way she answered, but always seeking the critical fact as to whether a Senate staffer said Judge Thomas might withdraw. And she said no. And then in the afternoon, and it comes up in the context I read, which might be interpreted to be not really responsive to the subject, but that aside, then she says, in response to my question, quote, "So Mr. Brudney did tell you that Judge Thomas might not wish to continue to go forward with his nomination if you came forward?" Professor Hill, yes. Now, my sense, Mr. President, and I say this to my colleagues who have to decide this issue, is that we have the tremendously difficult task of deciding who is correct, who is telling the truth. We have a number of factors that are really hard to evaluate, but some fair indicators of credibility. But in the context of this matter, on this kind of an important question, I went back the next morning, didn't come to any conclusions, tried to maintain an open mind, not as an advocate, but in rereading this testimony, it seemed to me that there was an intentional misstatement of fact. I questioned Judge Thomas in a straightforward, perhaps tough manner on the issue that Senator Byrd discussed when Judge Thomas said he hadn't watched the testimony of Professor Hill. And I said to Judge Thomas, I think you should have watched it. I find that very disappointing. And I was concerned that Judge Thomas had not watched that testimony. And doing the best that I could in terms of trying to get to the facts, that is what I attempted to do. And I believe that this transcript on this change of testimony has very significant weight on a decision as to the underlying credibility and what happened between this man and woman. No one's ever going to know. Only 2 people were present. And I listened to Professor Hill's 4 witnesses where she had talked to them before about the incident. I don't have time to analyze that. And I found them sincere people, and I weighed their credibility very, very carefully. But Mr. President, on the totality of this record, on the movement from education to EEOC, where she could have stated education after these statements were supposed to have been made, on the series of telephone calls, on the testimony of Professor Cothey about their laughing and talking together, about her driving her to her driving him to the airport, all in a context which is different from where you might expect her to want to maintain a professional relationship, more on the personal level. And then especially with 9 questions being asked and a denial of any conversation about trying to get him to withdraw on that change of testimony, Mr. President, in this very, very difficult proceeding, I come to the judgment that the weight of the evidence supports Judge Thomas. Now I'd be glad to yield to a question.
The Senator's time has expired.
Mr. President, I yield myself 15 minutes.
Senator Illinois is recognized for 15 minutes.
Mr. President, unfortunately, this whole issue and the debate that we have had, not just over the last 3 days, but is unnecessary if the process of advice and consent had taken place. I pointed out last week that we have had at least 8 instances in this century where a president has appointed someone of another political party. And in addition, presidents have appointed people who have differed very substantially in terms of philosophy. And I'm not going to go into all the detail, but the presidents, the Republican presidents who have done that in recent years have included Calvin Coolidge, Herbert Hoover, Richard Nixon, Dwight Eisenhower, and Gerald Ford. I've suggested that balance is needed. And in a column in Sunday's Washington Post, David Broder wrote, "Let the Senate Democratic majority exercise its constitutional authority to advise the president by passing a sense of the Senate resolution setting forth the professional and policy criteria it will use in deciding whether to confirm future court appointees. If Simon's idea of a balance in the court is what the Democrats want, let them say so. I will be introducing a resolution today, Mr. President, which I hope colleagues on both sides can join in approving, which says, whereas the Constitution calls on the Senate to give advice and consent to nominations to the United States Supreme Court, and whereas in recent times the advice portion of this phrase has not been exercised by the Senate, therefore be it resolved by the Senate that it is the sense of the Senate that first, that the President in determining whom to name to any future Supreme Court vacancies should keep philosophical balance in mind so that the law is not like a pendulum swinging back and forth depending on the philosophy of the president, and second, that before a name is submitted to the Senate, there should be informal bipartisan consultation with some members of the Senate on who is to be named to the Supreme Court before a name is submitted to the Senate. I ask unanimous consent that both the David Broder column and my resolution be inserted in the record at this point.
Without objection, is so ordered.
Mr. President, I am concerned.
If the senator would suspend momentarily, we do need order in the Senate. The senator may proceed.
Mr. President, I am concerned about what is being done to a witness who reluctantly came forward. And there is no better example than my colleague, and I say this while he is here, and we have discussed this on a TV program. There is no better example than to suggest that Professor Hill was committing perjury. The reality is there is not a single prosecutor in this nation who would read her full testimony who would suggest there is any perjury. I think, as a matter of fact, for 7 hours of testimony, she was remarkably consistent in what she had to say. And I agree with the distinguished President Pro Tem, Senator Byrd, the wise old lion of the Senate, who said he found her testimony thoughtful, reflective, and truthful. Let me just take for a moment the balance of what happened. And I respect those who come to differing conclusions, including my distinguished colleague from Illinois. But on the side of the judge, it seems to me, are the continued contacts. 11 phone calls over 7 years, a few other things. But psychiatrists say that is not unusual for someone who has been sexually harassed or sexually abused. What about on the other side? First of all, you have corroborating witnesses that said she talked to them about the abuses several years ago. Second is the question of motivation. Here is a reluctant witness who has no motivation other than doing her duty to this country who comes forward. Third, you have the question of details. She provided a great deal of great many details that I don't think someone would just make up. And if you were going to make up a story, you would make up a story that included physical abuse, physical contact. That wasn't there. Her hospital stay, the only hospital stay she had. Stress on the job, stomach pains. She and apparently her physician believed it was stress related. The lie detector. Now, Mr. President, I'm not a great believer in lie detectors. But you can't have it both ways, although let me just add, I don't find very many people who don't tell the truth who volunteer to the FBI that they're willing to take a lie detector test. But the FBI asked her whether she was willing to take a lie detector test. She said she was. She then took a lie detector test given by someone who works for the FBI, and then the same administration that asked her whether she would take a lie detector test attacked her for taking a lie detector test. You can't have it both ways. And finally, and I am neither an attorney nor a trial attorney, but Senator Byrd's comments about his failure to listen to her charges. I talked to an old trial lawyer, and I know the presiding officer is a former trial lawyer. Talked to an old trial lawyer who says, I can frequently tell whether my clients are innocent or guilty, because if they don't listen to the witnesses that are spelling out details of attack on them, they tend to be guilty. Now, all these are straws, but I suggest the straws in the wind come down on the side of Professor Hill as to who is telling the truth. Then beyond that, what are the other factors? One, that we should have an African American on the court. I favor diversity, but let me just add, the majority of African American organizations that have taken a stand have come on the other side. This morning, I called a distinguished former colleague of the House, Barbara Jordan, and I said, Barbara, if you were voting, how would you vote? She now teaches law at the University of Texas. And she said, I would vote no, and she explained why. I don't have the time to go into her explanations, but I said, can I use that on the floor? And she said, of course. The reality is, this nominee's views are either extreme or unknown. And he failed to give answers where I think there's a serious question of credibility. His votes will not be for working men and women in this nation. They will be for the privileged who can afford the finest attorneys. That's the reality. I want someone who's going to sit on the court, who's going to speak up for Americans who can't afford the high-priced attorneys. Finally, Mr. President, this whole question of the benefit of the doubt that Senator Byrd referred to, I hear this over and over again. This is not a trial where someone is going to be found innocent or guilty. We're not trying anyone. In that case, the benefit of the doubt should go to the accused. In this case, the benefit of the doubt should go to the people of this country. Mr. President, we have taken an oath in this body to protect and defend the Constitution. We have not taken an oath to protect our political hides. We have not taken an oath to do all kinds of other things. We have taken an oath to protect the institutions of this country. And I submit to you, there is serious doubt if we approve this nominee that we are protecting the institutions of this country as we should. Mr. President, I reserve the balance of my time. And if the senator from South Carolina does not have someone seeking the floor, I yield. I should consult with Senator Biden's staff. How much time does Senator Kennedy or Senator Kennedy know?
I think 15 minutes.
I yield 15 minutes to the senator from Massachusetts. The
distinguished senator from Massachusetts is recognized.
Thank you,
Senator Kennedy.
Very much, Mr. President. The question before the Senate today is not a referendum on the credibility of Judge Clarence Thomas or of Professor Anita Hill. The issue before us is the fate of the Supreme Court and the Constitution, now and for decades to come. It is no secret that I oppose Judge Thomas's nomination. The extreme views he expressed before his confirmation hearings demonstrate that he lacks a deep commitment to the fundamental constitutional values at the core of our democracy. It is hypocritical in the extreme for supporters of Judge Thomas to bitterly criticize the conduct of certain advocacy groups in the controversy over the charges by Professor Hill, when it is clear that Judge Thomas was nominated precisely to advance the agenda of the right wing. I oppose any effort by this administration to pack the Supreme Court with justices who will turn back the clock on issues of vital importance for the future of our nation and for the kind of country we want America to be. But over the past 9 days, the debate on this nomination has been transformed, and the nation has been transfixed by the charges of sexual harassment made by Professor Anita Hill, and by the Judiciary Committee's hearings into these charges over the past weekend. With extraordinary courage and dignity, Professor Hill expressed the pain and anguish experienced by so many women who have been victims of sexual harassment on the job. She described the suffering and the humiliation that a woman encounters when her career and her livelihood are threatened by a supervisor who fills every workday with anxiety about when the next offensive action and the next embarrassing incident will occur. The hearings on Professor Hill's charges were exhaustive, and they were difficult and painful for all the participants, witnesses and senators alike. But the hearings educated the country on an issue of great and growing significance. Overnight, as on perhaps no other issue in our history, the entire country made a giant leap of understanding about sexual harassment. That offensive conduct will never be treated lightly again. All women and all men too owe Professor Hill a tremendous debt of gratitude for her willingness to discuss her experience and for the courage and dignity with which she did so. The most distressing aspect of the hearings was the eagerness with which many of Judge Thomas's supporters resorted to innuendos and scurrilous attacks on Professor Hill for her testimony about her charges of deeply offensive and humiliating actions by Judge Thomas. They have charged that Professor Hill's allegations were an effort to play on racial fears and racial stereotypes. But the issue here is sexual oppression, not racial oppression. I spend much of my public life fighting against discrimination in all its ugly forms, and I intend to keep on making that fight. I reject the notion that racism is relevant to this controversy. It involves an Afro-American man and an Afro-American woman, and it ultimately involves the character of America itself. The struggle for racial justice, in its truest sense, was meant to wipe out all forms of oppression. No one, least of all Judge Thomas, is entitled to invoke one form of oppression to excuse another. The deliberate, provocative use of a term like lynching is not only wrong in fact, it is a gross misuse of America's most historic tragedy and pain to buy a political advantage. The Senate today is not passing judgment solely on Judge Thomas or Professor Hill. The Senate is making a fundamental statement about our values and our conscience. Make no mistake about it. We in the Senate are also passing judgment on ourselves. Are we an old boys club, insensitive at best and perhaps something worse? Will we strain to concoct any excuse, to impose any burden, to tolerate any unsubstantiated attack on a woman in order to rationalize a vote for this nomination? Will we refuse to heed the rights and claims of the majority of Americans who are women, but who are so much a minority in this chamber? What kind of Senate are we? Because if we cannot listen and respond to this woman, as credible as she is, with the significant corroboration she offers, then what message are we sending to women across America? What American woman in the future will dare to come forward? There is no proof that Anita Hill has perjured herself, and shame on anyone who suggests that she has. There is no proof that any advocacy groups made Anita Hill say what she said or made up a story for her to repeat. And shame on anyone who suggests that this is what happened. There is no proof at all that Anita Hill is fantasizing these charges or is mentally unbalanced. And shame on anyone desperate enough to suggest that she is. The treatment of Anita Hill is what every woman fears who thinks of lifting the veil and revealing her sexual harassment. Here in the Senate and in the nation, we need to establish a different, better, higher standard. When confronted with all of the evidence that corroborates Professor Hill's charges, Judge Thomas's supporters abandoned the craven charge that she had concocted the story in recent weeks. Instead, they resorted to the meanest and most unfounded cut of all, that this tenured law professor, who testified with such grace and dignity, is delusional, that she somehow fantasized the entire horrible experience, that baseless charge is an insult to Professor Hill and to the millions of American women who have been the victims of sexual harassment. For too long, persons accused of sexual harassment have responded by charging their victims with being sick, with making the whole thing up, with living in a fantasy world, or that such allegations amount to nothing more than women taking a passing word in the wrong way. Calculated slurs of that kind scare other women into silence. And the greatest irony of all is that the very same people who are now making that irresponsible charge are those who have criticized Professor Hill for not making her own charges sooner. If we allow these kinds of vicious attacks on Professor Hill to stand, if we dismiss her charges as fantasy or delusion, the message to women throughout America will be a chilling one. Suffer in silence or pay a terrible price. Sexual harassment is an intensely private offense that rarely occurs in front of witnesses. The EEOC itself ruled in 1983 that a claim of sexual harassment can be based on a woman's word alone without further corroboration. And EEOC guidelines make clear that harassment of one woman can constitute an offense without the need to demonstrate a pattern of such conduct involving other women. The absence of any intent by the perpetrator to harm the victim does not mean that there has been no harm. Words and actions may still turn the workplace into an ordeal for any woman who makes a conscientious decision to stick to her career and who decides that the only practical course is to deal with her harasser without recourse to the law. And in this case, the person charged by Professor Hill with sexual harassment was not only the head of the agency where she worked, but the federal official with the chief responsibility for enforcing the laws of the United States against sexual harassment. Judge Thomas and his supporters have pointed with outrage to the harm that these hearings have done to him. But what about the harm that was done to Professor Hill? And I'm not talking only about the Senate proceedings that she was so reluctant to set in motion. I'm talking about the 2 years of harm that she endured because of this harassment. I'm talking about the 8 years more of harm she endured because of the silence she was forced to accept in a society that has been hostile to such claims for so long. It's never been easy for any woman to bring a charge of sexual harassment. Attitudes are changing in our society. Our national consciousness has been raised by the events of recent days. And the lesson of these changes should be a part of the conscience of the Supreme Court, too. I wonder in this day and age whether women are prepared to sit still while the United States puts Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court of the United States. The Senate shot itself in the foot last week. Let us not shoot ourselves in the other foot today. We all know what happened last Monday and Tuesday when Anita Hill's press conference in Oklahoma launched a tidal wave of anger by women across America. They were outraged because the Bush administration and the Republican leadership in the Senate stubbornly persisted in trying to force a vote on the Thomas nomination without even hearing Professor Hill's serious charges of sexual harassment. Today, therefore, it will not be easy to vote against Anita Hill. All America has seen her face to face in their living rooms. Wives are talking to their husbands. Daughters are talking to fathers. Sisters are talking to brothers. They saw what we saw. They saw a courageous woman who seemed to be speaking for all women, a tenured professor of law with a successful career. She had nothing to gain and everything to lose by coming forward. Under great pressure, she testified with surprising grace and extraordinary dignity. Her testimony was corroborated by four eloquent and persuasive witnesses. Though there is forceful testimony from Judge Thomas's supporters, all of them acknowledge that they had no personal knowledge about whether Professor Hill was telling the truth or not. And I believe Professor Hill. I recognize that most of the country is left with doubts about what really happened, and so are many senators. There is no conclusive answer yet, but the Senate has to vote today, and what is the Senate to do? In my view, senators who are unsure about who is telling the truth should vote against this nomination. The Bush administration is urging the Senate to give the benefit of the doubt to the nominee. If this were a criminal proceeding or even a civil lawsuit, that assertion would be correct. But the issue before the Senate today is a proceeding of a very different kind. The question is whether Judge Clarence Thomas should be appointed to the highest court in the land, whether he should be entrusted with the solemn power to have the last word on the meaning of the Constitution and the fundamental rights of all Americans. Throughout the two centuries of our history, many, if not all, of the most important issues of our democracy have been resolved by the Supreme Court. All Americans, men and women, must have faith in the fairness and the integrity of the members of that court, in their ability to do justice for every citizen, and in their commitment to do justice. On a question of such vast and lasting significance, where the course of our future for years to come is riding on our decision, the Senate should give the benefit of the doubt to the Supreme Court and the Constitution, not to Judge Clarence Thomas. Perhaps there are some senators who feel that Judge Thomas has overwhelmingly succeeded in disproving Professor Hill's charges. But few senators and few Americans who watch the hearings would come to that conclusion. America is divided. If we make a mistake today, the Supreme Court will be living with it, and the nation will be living with it for the next 30 or 40 years. That is too high a price to pay, too great a risk to take. To give the benefit of the doubt to Judge Thomas is to say that Judge Thomas is more important than the Supreme Court. Surely, whatever the faults and flaws of the confirmation process, the President of the United States can find another nominee for the Supreme Court who's not under the cloud of having committed serious acts of sexual harassment. Most Americans are not lawyers, but in their daily lives, they often make critical decisions about themselves, their families, and their future. They weigh the risks and the consequences, the likely probabilities and the reasonable doubts. Few of us would buy a home in a community near a nuclear waste dump, even though the risk of radiation may be extremely small. We don't allow cancer-causing pesticides in our food supply, even though the risk of illness is vanishingly small. None of us would stand under a tree in a thunderstorm because there's a reasonable doubt we might be struck by lightning. None of us would board an airplane if we had reasonable doubt about the competence of the pilot. We do not take these actions because the action is not worth the risk if we are wrong. The Senate should apply the same test to the nomination of Judge Clarence Thomas. The Senate has a constitutional responsibility to the Supreme Court and to the American people. The risk of being wrong is too great. Judge Thomas will continue to be a judge, but he should not be confirmed as a member of the nation's highest court. Mr. President, I would like to include at an appropriate place in the record additional the transcript of the record that follows the statements of the senator from Pennsylvania that have not been put in to the record at this time, and would urge those that have followed the senator from Pennsylvania's reading of selected portions of that record would have their attention drawn to following questions over the next two pages. As I stated in the hearing itself, it's very clear what she was saying, Professor Hill, to Senator Specter. She said no one on the committee staff had suggested to her that Judge Thomas might withdraw quickly and quietly simply because she made an allegation to the committee. Later she said the possibility of withdrawal had come up, but in the context of a very different kind of conversation about the various things that might happen down the road, as one of a broad range of possible outcomes if Professor Hill reported what happened. That's an obvious distinction between the two statements, and it's preposterous to call it perjury.
The request of the senator will be granted, and the statement will be reproduced in the record in full as requested. The distinguished senior senator from Massachusetts yields the floor. Who seeks?
This is the Senate debate on the nomination of Judge Clarence Thomas to sit on the Supreme Court.
Senator from
because of the importance of this decision, the Senate has dispensed with its usual Tuesday luncheon recess and will debate right through this period. The senators have approximately 4.5 hours of additional debate.
That's right, Paul. And once again, you're listening to and watching the debate on the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the United States Supreme Court. Speaking right now is Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania.
People who will read the evidence to make a determination about what a fair reading of that evidence is. But I would suggest that when the senator from Massachusetts talks about shame, he oughtn't to direct it to the argument that there was an intentional misstatement of fact. And this senator spent virtually all of his time going over that in detail to illustrate the complexity of the matter and how you have to get right down to the syllables and the semicolons to see what was said. And I submit, on the basis of what I read and the totality of the record, that it is plain that any fair-minded person would say a fair reading of that record was that Professor Hill at first denied that there had been any statement by a staffer that Judge Thomas might be forced to withdraw and then flatly changed that testimony. We do not need characterizations like shame in this chamber from the senator from Massachusetts. One other point, Mr. President, and that is that the women of America should not listen to the senator from Massachusetts who is trying to arouse the passion on the generalized subject of sexual harassment. This senator and every senator decries sexual harassment. This proceeding is not a question of whether sexual harassment exists in this country, because it does. And virtually all of it is unreported and unpunished. But the message should not go out to the women of America that the United States Senate is indifferent to sexual harassment, and that if a woman comes forward and offers evidence, that it will be disregarded. This senator has been at the forefront with the senator from Massachusetts in trying to get a civil rights bill, which is designed directly on the issue of sexual harassment. I take second place to no one on that subject. But when the senator from Massachusetts seeks to terrify the women of America that they cannot step forward because they will not be properly treated, he's wrong. And I would suggest that the only issue in this matter is who was correct, Professor Hill or Judge Thomas. And Professor Hill was treated courteously, properly, politely, her corroborating witnesses were carefully examined, and the decision which is being made, at least by this senator, is on the facts with the weight of the evidence in support of Judge Thomas. And I'm talking about the evidence.
The senator's time has expired. Now, does the senator, the distinguished senior senator from Massachusetts, ask recognition? Who yields time for that purpose,
if
he does?
Mr. President, I yield time to 1 minute to the senator from Massachusetts.
Mr. President.
Senator from Massachusetts.
Mr. President, I stand with my rejection of the conclusions that have been made by the senator from Pennsylvania that Professor Hill was guilty of perjury. I expressed my opinions about that over the course of the hearing. I'm not going to take the time to do that during this all part of the record. And I reiterate, Mr. President, I reiterate to the senator from Pennsylvania and to others that the way that Professor Hill was treated was shameful, was shameful. I yield the ballot.
Senator from Massachusetts yields the floor, and who yields time? Does the distinguished senior senator from New Jersey ask time? Senator from Illinois.
Mr. President, I yield 12 minutes to the senator from New Jersey.
The distinguished senior senator from New Jersey is recognized for 12 minutes.
Mr. President, before Professor Anita Hill's story became known, I declared my opposition to the nomination of Judge Clarence Thomas. I did so on the floor here nearly 2 weeks ago. I based my opposition on his public record, his professional work, his performance before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and my disagreement with President Bush that he was, in the President's word, the best person for this position. And, Mr. President, I ask unanimous consent if my full statement made at that time be a part of this record.
I'll be admitted in the record.
Mr. President, has anything transpired that would change my vote or my opposition? The nation has watched this drama, charges and countercharges unfold on TV. And although my perspective is limited by race and gender, the events of the last 4 days remind me that we need more civility in public life and that those who serve deserve some privacy and some statute of limitations. We have witnessed a distasteful and on some levels disgusting set of hearings in the Judiciary Committee. But what was offensive was not only the description of lurid sexual details that children shouldn't hear, but also the way the men in the White House and their allies on the committee chose to wage the battle. The strategy to deal with Professor Hill, designed by the men in the White House and apparently approved by President Bush, was the ultimate in sexual stereotyping and sly innuendo, replete with gross and irrelevant references to the modern cliche of witchcraft, The Exorcist. The men in the White House set out to say that Anita Hill was a liar, even though they couldn't prove it, even though 4 people corroborated her story, and even though she passed a lie detector test. The men in the White House set out to say that she was unbalanced, that she'd fantasized all she said, even though one person who alleged fantasy retracted the characterization, and the second revealed himself as a self-promoting man with no special psychiatric knowledge. Finally, they set out to say that she was a part of a conspiracy of interest groups, the press, and U.S. Senate staff, all coordinating and keying off of each other in a blatant smear, even though no one could explain the motive for her stepping forward or the connection between the groups and her powerful words. After Professor Hill's credible testimony, the men in the White House decided to blame Professor Hill for stepping forward, even though she did so only at the committee's request. They looked to discredit her in surprisingly crude ways. They said she should have taken notes, she should have spoken out, she should have left her job, she should have filed a complaint. Never mind that the Supreme Court did not recognize verbal abuse alone as a cause for action until 1986. Never mind that only 7% of the women who report sexual harassment in surveys actually file complaints. Never mind that under current law, Professor Hill would have gained no damages and possibly no final resolution for up to 3 years. Indeed, she would have gained only the reputation of a troublemaker who, in the workplace, would have been shunned in 1,000 small ways and unable to move on with a positive recommendation. Never mind that some of the senators who said she should have filed a complaint voted against the legislation that gave her the right to complain or have fought against efforts to allow damages for intentional sex discrimination. Never mind all that. What the men in the White House revealed through the strategy of attacking Professor Hill's character was colossal insensitivity to victims of alleged sexual harassment, an insensitivity that flows from the same source that sees a battered wife and says, "Prove the man did it." What the men in the White House were saying is, "We would have spoken up, we would have left the job, we would have taken notes, we would have filed a complaint. How could anyone have a sense of vulnerability about going into the conflict of illegal proceedings? How could someone absorb the abuse Professor Hill described and not fight back? How could anyone submerge pain?" Finally, what the men in the White House were saying is, "Why can't she have been more like us? We're all gunfighters. Our way, the men's way is the best. The treatment that the men in the White House gave to Professor Hill illustrates better than 1,000 psychological studies why women are reluctant to step forward. It's dangerous. Imagine in another circumstance if she were your daughter. How would you feel? If a woman with her credibility and courage can't do it, how can someone else stand up? Ironically, the man who treated Professor Hill with the greatest respect during the hearings was Clarence Thomas. He was considerate when he spoke of her amidst the anger that he spewed at the committee for his predicament. He refused to offer interpretations of why she had done it. He would not be drawn in to character assassination. On Friday night, Clarence Thomas showed his racial pain and his racial anger for the first time in the confirmation process. It was probably a truer emotion than all the intellectualizing, dodging, and denying that was a part of his earlier appearances before the committee. He used his race in a way he had always refused to. He identified with the shared experiences of black suffering and black indignities at the hands of whites. He became stronger and more vulnerable when his life and reputation were on the line. Yet he failed to focus his anger. He was right to be outraged about the leak, and whoever's responsible should be punished. But it was Anita Hill, not the U.S. Senate, who made the charges. Should a more thorough investigation have taken place before the committee vote? Yes. Was the leak reprehensible? Yes. Should last week's full hearing have been done in executive session? Possibly. But what remains are not issues of process, but charges of fact, charges that remain unresolved. Then on Saturday, after the Friday night when his racial anger came pouring from his heart, Clarence Thomas offered racial stereotyping as a defense against the charge of sexual harassment. But here he was on thin ice, because he had not expressed outrage, nor did he even criticize his president's use of the black rapist murderer Willie Horton to scare up some white votes in 1988, even though Horton was the ultimate stereotype. Then Clarence Thomas remained strangely silent in a clearly calculated way. That was just politics, people say, no big thing. To which I say, everything's politics, including relations between the races and the sexes. And embedded in all politics are moral values to which one cannot be selectively dedicated. In this case, there is the value of recognizing that each distinct human being has a right to his or her own complex individuality, and there is the imperative to resist one-dimensional stereotyping as destructive of our common humanity. To be true to your values, you have to speak out wherever you are and whatever the circumstance. You don't assert moral values only to save your own neck. During the confirmation process, Clarence Thomas continually referred back to his politically attractive personal journey from Pinpoint, Georgia, as if he were a modern candidate repeating his soundbite. President Bush's reaction after listening to the story in Thomas's opening statement was, in the president's words, "I don't think there was a dry eye in the House." The great African-American novelist Richard Wright, in writing about his great book, Native Son, gives another view of such tears. He says, "I found I had written a book that even the banker's daughter could read and weep over and feel good about. I swore to myself that if I ever wrote another book, no one would weep over it, that it would be so hard and deep that they would have to face it without the consolation of tears." Today, 50 years after Wright penned those words, America can't afford to sentimentalize black life. significant parts of the African-American community are being devastated and are self-destructing daily. Instead, we must take rights hard and deep look. Maybe now, Clarence Thomas will take the hard and deep look at his potential role in American life. Maybe now he'll see that if he's confirmed, it was largely because he asserted a strong racial identity and that he owes nothing to the president who denied race was even a factor in his selection. Maybe having been tested in the crucible of an excruciatingly painful experience, he'll be different. Maybe now he'll come home. This is only to say that after this weekend, my doubt that in Maya Angelou's words, Clarence Thomas is young and can be won over again is a little less, but not sufficiently less to change my vote. I yield the floor.
Mr. President.
Senator from Vermont. Who yields time? Senator from South Carolina.
Well, Mr. President, if the senator from South Carolina wants me to, I have the floor, but I'll withhold if he wishes to speak on his time, and I...
The chair will observe that the time is controlled.
No, no, I yield the senator from...
No, you don't have to yield to me. I get it on my own.
Who yields time? Senator from South Carolina?
I yield myself 10 minutes.
The senator is recognized for 10 minutes. There will be order.
Mr. President, in my nearly 37 years as a member of the United States Senate, I've always taken a great deal of pride in both this institution and our duty of advice and consent. I've thought of the Senate as an edifice of integrity, comity, and deliberation, frequently abrupted by the high winds of politics and personality, but standing firm, entrenched in the bedrock of the Constitution and buttressed by the equity of its rules and procedures. However, as we arrived at the unprecedented decision to reopen these hearings, I have watched this edifice being profoundly shaken. Waves of base sensationalism, prurience, and vicious political mudslinging have eaten away at the very foundation of the Senate and the confirmation process. I am outraged and ashamed by the perversion of the process which has occurred, and I am profoundly saddened by the damage that has been done to a man of impeccable character, immense courage, and deep compassion. A man many of us have come to respect and admire. If we are to salvage our constitutional role in this instance, Mr. President, we must strip away the hysteria which has surrounded this whole affair and return to the facts. Before I go any further, Mr. President, I would like to commend our distinguished chairman, Senator Biden, for his fairness under extremely difficult circumstances. He has a tough job, but he has done it fairly and with respect for all concerned. Now for the facts of Professor Anita Hill. Mr. President, this is a woman not one of us knows personally and whose background has not been investigated for anywhere close to 100 days. The allegations she has raised are the most serious kind, and the behavior she described was hateful and disgusting. Yet her testimony has provided us with many more questions than answers. If this behavior did take place, why did she wait 10 years, I repeat, 10 long years, to bring this charge? Why did she not bring it up to investigators or even to the media during Judge Thomas's four previous confirmation hearings? If she was being harassed while working for Clarence Thomas at the Department of Education, why did she follow him, I repeat, follow him to the EEOC? Why would she continue to subject herself to these unwelcome advances? Not one of desperation for a job. For contrary to what she told this committee, she could have easily kept her job at the Department of Education. In addition, Professor Hill was and is an attorney. She must have been well aware there was legal redress available to her if she was being harassed, especially as an employee of the agency responsible for enforcing civil rights protection. Professor Hill must have been aware of the procedures for bringing such a charge and for keeping contemporaneous records of such treatment. Why did she not bring charges against this man if he was harassing her? After leaving the Washington area, why did Professor Hill maintain a cordial relationship with a man who treated her so badly that she had to be hospitalized for stress? Why would she telephone Clarence Thomas just to say hello, or even more bizarre, to congratulate him on his marriage? Professor Hill's statement and actions are not congruent. The Judiciary Committee is not capable of discerning a clear motive for Professor Hill to tell an untruth, but I believe that is what has occurred. Ms. Perrin, it has been suggested that Ms. Hill wished for a romantic involvement with Judge Thomas and felt rejected when he was not interested in her. Mr. Dawley's testimony and that of Ms. Phyllis Barry Myers indicates that this may be the case. Some have said that Judge Thomas did not promote Professor Hill to a position she coveted. Perhaps she is being vindictive for what she considers to be a professional slight. In addition, after moving to the EEOC from the Department of Education, she was relegated to a position of less prominence and diminished access to Judge Thomas. Perhaps her ego was bruised. Professor Hill also told FBI investigators that she had doubts about Judge Thomas's political philosophy, that she felt he had changed his beliefs and that he would not be open-minded. Perhaps the root of this whole thing is a disagreement over political philosophy. I have been contacted by several psychiatrists suggesting that it is entirely possible she is suffering from delusions. Perhaps she is living in a fantasy world. Dean Coffey, the founding dean of the School of Law at Oral Roberts University, who knew both of them well, has stated his opinion that Ms. Hill's allegations are not only unbelievable, but preposterous and the product of fantasy. Mr. President, I do not believe any of us can know exactly what Anita Hill's motivation could be for impugning Judge Thomas in this manner. Furthermore, it is not our job to know. It is our job to weigh the testimony presented to us and attempt to discern the truth. Mr. President, a great injustice has been committed here. The good name of a good man has been tarnished. I do not believe Judge Thomas is capable of the kind of behavior Professor Hill described to this committee, and I do not believe that Professor Hill is telling the truth. Mr. President, the book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible says, every man has three names. One his father and mother gave him, one others call him, and one he acquires himself. Clarence Thomas's parents and grandparents gave him a good, strong name, a name he could be proud of. He has earned for himself an honorable name as a man of integrity and rectitude. And up until this week, that was also the name by which others also knew him. Now that name, the product of 43 years of hard work and striving for excellence, has been snatched from him and dragged through the mire. We cannot restore it to him in its wholeness. We cannot restore to him his peace of mind on his belief in the fairness of this system. However, we can dismiss these charges against him for what they are: baseless, incredible, inconsistent, and simply unbelievable. Mr. President, Judge Thomas will be an outstanding member of the United States Supreme Court. As I have said on many occasions, his background provides him with the ability to fulfill his responsibilities in an outstanding manner, and he should be confirmed. Mr. President, I am proud that Judge Thomas has been appointed. I think he will make an excellent member of the United States Supreme Court. I yield the floor.
Yields time.
Mr. President, how much time is left on both sides?
Now, Mr. President, I'm kind of short of time. As you know, I've sent my entire statement to the record.
Senator from Illinois controls 81 minutes. Senator from South Carolina controls 142 minutes. Who yields time?
Mr. President, I yield 10 minutes to the senator from Vermont.
Senator's recognized for 10 minutes.
Mr. President, in the midst of what have been attacks, sloganeering, smears, and innuendos, many of us during the past few days have tried to make an independent judgment rather than making speeches and waging a political campaign. And we were right to do that, because we were faced with two diametrically opposed stories. And I kept coming back to the question, of what Anita Hill had to gain from making her story known, and the answer is nothing. Professor Hill presented her disturbing story with dignity, with courage, intelligence, and she maintained an extraordinary grace under the pressure of a political onslaught that was orchestrated by the White House. The Thomas supporters built a case against her on a house of cards made of falsehoods, innuendo, and plain old-fashioned political smears. She was a perjurer, they said. She said she might be a spurned woman. She was a bitter bureaucrat passed over for a better job. She was a tool of interest groups who wrote her testimony. Her story was concocted at the 11th hour. The Thomas supporters even did readings from The Exorcist. They claimed that she was perverted, claimed that she was self-deluded, claimed that she might belong in an asylum. And the senators who have described themselves as the defenders of family values came up with every explanation for her testimony except the most obvious, that she was telling the truth. Professor Hill had nothing to gain by coming to Congress and coming to Washington. And what she got was a crash course in character assassination. Is it any wonder that she hesitated to come forth 8 years ago or today? And her experience is an object lesson for women about the risks of speaking out. Her attackers cry out against her for not coming forward 8 years ago. At the same time, they maul and harass her for coming forward today. If anyone needs to know why so many women keep experiences of sexual harassment or rape locked up inside, they need look no further than Anita Hill's 72 hours in Washington. And if the Senate fails to show respect for Professor Hill's testimony, what are we telling the world? What are we telling the 19-year-old waitress who's sexually harassed? Or the 23-year-old secretary who's sexually harassed by the most powerful man in her company? If Professor Hill, who's well-educated and successful, is treated as though she were mentally ill, what's going to happen to poor or uneducated victims? The message would be very clear. If you dare to challenge a powerful man, you're going to be crushed. And that is a message that the administration and its supporters should be deeply ashamed to send to this country. I'm sad that once again, race was used as a tool for short-term political gain, with no regard for the destruction that tactic will wreak on our nation. From Willie Horton to the Civil Rights Bill to Clarence Thomas's claim of lynching, it appears to me that the administration is willing to use race to its advantage time and time again. Mr. President, I believe Anita Hill. And none of her opponents dared to say directly that Anita Hill was not a very moving and credible person. Her corroborative witnesses who testified to Professor Hill told them at the time, about Clarence Thomas's unwanted sexual advances. Those witnesses were unimpeachable, and they were not impeached. And they had no reason to lie, just as Anita Hill had no reason to lie. And their testimony demolished the White House claim that Professor Hill's story was an 11th hour fabrication. Professor Hill testified that Judge Thomas described X-rated movies to her in detail. Judge Thomas and his supporters denied that such conversation was unimaginable for a man of his upright characters. Dean Cote, cited just a few minutes ago by the distinguished ranking member of this committee, said Judge Thomas is a man who would only read a book on religion or philosophy. That's the site that was just used to demonstrate who he is. One of Judge Thomas's strongest supporters, Lavita Coleman, admitted to the press last week that Judge Thomas regaled her and other friends with descriptions of pornographic movies while they're students in law school. And we've been presented no evidence that his willingness to discuss pornographic films came to an abrupt halt on the day he left law school. And if one believes Anita Hill's testimony as I do, it's obvious it didn't halt when he came to Washington. And what of Clarence Thomas? Even if only 10% of what Anita Hill said is true, then Clarence Thomas's categorical denial to the committee under oath is untrue. Every senator's going to vote in this nomination according to his or her own conscience. But remember, if Judge Thomas is confirmed, he will serve in the United States Supreme Court for decades, for life. And why would Judge Thomas lie? Suppose for the moment that Professor Hill is telling the truth and it all happened behind closed doors and there are no witnesses. Do men who have committed sexual harassment come out and say, well, of course I did it? Most men in that position say one of two things. Either she misunderstood harmless flirting, or the woman's obviously crazy. And most men caught in sexual harassment don't admit it, they deny it. Now, Senator Simpson quoted Shakespeare the other day. Let me paraphrase from Hamlet. Judge Thomas doth protest too much. In the battle over motives, let's recognize that Judge Thomas has a simple motive, to join the highest court in the land. And senators on the other side have turned cartwheels to invent a reason why Professor Hill would sacrifice all she has just to give false testimony before this body.